Good evening. Despite a brief technical problem, I think we're now ready to begin. I'm Deanna Markham, the Associate Librarian for Library Services, and on behalf of the Librarian of Congress, James Billington, I welcome all of you to this symposium this evening. I thank C-SPAN for making this program available to a much wider audience. It's been a real pleasure working with C-SPAN, and I thank them for all that they've done to help. I'm sure that all of you have heard the same message that I hear all the time, that the internet changes everything. And when I came to the library just over a year ago, I began asking a single question of all the staff. What must we do to be successful in the 21st century? How will the library of the future be as successful as that we have so loved in the past? And I've been particularly interested in asking, how will the internet change the nature of our work? And what must we think about in quite different ways? Fortunately, we have as part of the Library of Congress the John W. Kluge Center, and to it comes a great variety of scholars from many different disciplines. And they come here to carry out their own scholarship, but they also come to talk with us about the implications of many of these broad social issues so that they help us think about the work we are doing every day. So I've been asking some of the scholars in the Kluge Center to help us think about our mission, is to make information accessible to as many people as possible. We are very fortunate this year to have Derek de Kerckhoff in the Kluge Center. He holds the Papamarku Chair in Education and Technology within the Kluge Center. And he has been working carefully with us to help frame some of these questions. And as part of our discussion, we have launched this series called Managing Knowledge and Creativity in the Digital Context. This symposium series will go on for 6 months. There will be one lecture a month for the next 6 months. All of them will be broadcast by C-SPAN. They will be webcast on the Library of Congress webpage. You will see from the list of scholars that we're bringing some of the best thinkers in this field to come to talk with us. So I'm going to turn to Derek in just a few minutes to introduce our first distinguished lecturer in this series. But you see that we have other people sitting here as well. So let me introduce them very briefly before we begin. Dr. Robert Martin is the chairman of the Institute of Museum and Library Services, a government organization that promotes libraries and museums and other cultural agencies. And Eric Delfino is from our Technology Policy Directorate here at the Library of Congress. They are prepared to respond to our speaker's presentation after he's finished. And you will also see that there are lots of cameras in the room and there's a laptop in the back. We have a much bigger audience than you see here in this room tonight. Already we have heard from viewers in Mexico City and many parts of the United States who started asking questions by email, even though they haven't heard anything yet. They've just seen the announcement of the program. So we know we're going to have a lively discussion with those of you in this room and those of you who are watching the presentation. But at this time, it is my great pleasure to introduce Derek de Kerckhoff, who will talk a little bit more about the series and introduce our speaker. Thank you all for being here.
Good evening, and thank you, Deanna, for this lovely introduction. And thank also the Kluge Center for organizing this, and the Papamaku Chair and the Papamaku Foundation. I'm extremely grateful, obviously, for the challenge of given to me by this chair and by the foundation to explore the connection between technology and knowledge. And this is probably the most timely thing to do in the context of education and technology today, to explore in the context also of the library. And the reason being that in my work, what I have been exploring was most of my work has been devoted to the study of the effect of the alphabet on the culture and on the organization, the cognitive organization of our mind. And every time we change the basis of our, the basic medium supporting language, we change some fundamental strategies, ways of thinking and ways of feeling, ways of being in the world. The society of context is a society of an oral culture where you have nothing written down and everything is has to be in context. And history is relived, not written down, not stored away. There is no history. Everything is in the present. Once you can write and read and write and put text outside of context, when you can draw the text out of the context, you put it in new context, and then you create fiction, which is a small part, but you also create technology, which is an endless process. And now we're in a society of hypertext, which is the electronic transformation of language. So we had the oral culture of the spoken word, the written, the literate culture of the text, and now we have the electronic culture, and the electronic transformation of language is an acceleration beyond anything ever, that ever happened before. The biggest mythical technological marriage was the one between the telegraph, in the telegraph between language and electricity, maximum speed with maximum complexity. And that's what we're exploring in this series. What's the consequence of electrifying the word? And what's the consequence on knowledge patterns and ways of storing and retrieving knowledge? So this series really is asking the most, I would say, the most forward-thinking persons in the world of this new technological environment to tell us what they see, how they feel this is changing their profession, their interest, and also how it would affect education and, of course, also libraries. The first speaker in the series is David Weinberger, and David Weinberger is enormously talented, and he's also very modest, so that he didn't want me to give, you know, the full measure of everything that are in these notes. He has a website, by the way, which is quite fun, where his CV exists in three versions, a left brain, a right brain, and a no brain. Let me read you the no brain, which is really quite charming. Him ride good, him help companies do stuff, him smell okay. So that gives you, now, you know, everything that David does, he does in a very big way. He has not just, you know, written books, but he's written bestsellers. You know, it's quite a wonderful thing. The Clue Train Manifesto is a bestseller that he co-wrote. He not only writes jokes and does jokes, he writes them for Woody Allen. And he has been a comedy writer for Woody Allen for 7 years. He learns to blog. He is Mr. Blog America. He knows everything about blogs. You don't. I don't. But he'll tell you a bit. But he doesn't just blog. He goes and propels Howard Dean from being a nobody to be a very somebody. And he was the internet advisor for the campaign of Howard Dean. So all of this, he would say, I'm just bringing hype. But in fact, the books are there. Two of them, The Clue Train Manifesto and another one called Small Pieces Loosely Joined. And then many, many other writings too. Just to wit, he writes for the New York Times, Harvard Business Review, the Miami Herald, the Boston Globe, and Wired. By the way, not this issue of Wired, but the last issue of Wired has an extremely useful article for people who are interested in classification and particularly retrieving without a meta-text photographs. It's quite something. Newsweek, the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times, and so on. So he, of course, he, Woody Allen does use his jokes, and of course, no, Howard Dean did not win the election, but that was not David Weinberger's fault. To console himself, he is writing another book, And the title of the book is what is the title of this evening's talk. It's The Shape of Knowledge and Why Everything is Miscellaneous. So I'm going to bring him over here and ask him to give his talk and explain why everything is miscellaneous. But before I do that, I must remind people who are listening to this that they should ask their questions and send their questions to mail the question to digital@loc.gov. That's people who are listening to the broadcast. David Weinberger, please explain to us why everything is miscellaneous.
Thank you very much, Derek. That was an overly generous introduction. I need to take parts of it back. I did for a long time ago. I wrote gags for Woody Allen, and Howard Dean was doing really, really well before I became a sort of minor advisor. So, but thank you. Everything's miscellaneous because everything actually is miscellaneous. And the reason why I think this is worth talking about is that for a long time, on the order of millennia, we've assumed that knowledge stops at the miscellaneous. That when you get down to the miscellaneous, that's the stuff you couldn't classify anymore or categorize. So that's stuff not worth knowing or not knowable. I think what's going on now is that we're beginning to find that knowledge actually begins with the miscellaneous. That there's, I think, possibly a large change in what constitutes knowledge. And that's what I want to talk about with you tonight. And I'm honored and privileged to be able to do this. So thank you very much. You know, we've been digitizing information. You may have noticed that sort of a worldwide effort to bring things online. It's been going pretty well, you know, hundreds of billions of pages, so it's going pretty well. But as we do that, we're discovering that the principles by which we order, categorize, classify, arrange, organize stuff, understand stuff, that the principles that we've used for doing that developed in the real world, obviously. And it turns out that they are also limited by the real world. As we bring things online, the techniques by which we organize them, we're having to invent new principles that frequently invalidate the old principles. But the old principles are deeply tied to the question of what knowledge is. In fact, what knowledge is has been basically how we organize it and categorize it. So that's a big change, and it's worth noticing and I think worth spending some time on. So that's what I want to talk about. The state of knowledge is, I think it's not going too far to say that knowledge is in trouble. It's had a nice run, but there are cracks in the foundation. And you can see sort of little indications of, and these are all little indications, all over the place. These are cracks in knowledge and cracks in authority, since authority and knowledge have gone together in important ways. So you know, ask Dan Rather, who was 19 minutes into his presentation before the first bloggers were raising questions about the documents he was talking about. He was still on air. So that's a little crack in what constitutes an authority. Think about the role that news has traditionally played and how skeptical we are of it now. In fact, this guy, Jon Stewart, is, by many accounts, the best journalist on TV. He's a comedian. And frankly, I would not argue with that characterization of him. That's a crack in authority and a crack in knowledge. Farnaz Fasihi is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, reports from Baghdad. She wrote an email that got heavily blogged, you know, web-blogged, that talked in a more personal voice about what's going on in Baghdad. And in some ways, more truth emerged from this than what emerges from the gray pages of the great newspapers. Because this was written in a real human voice. Newspaper journalism has learned it's the technique of stripping voice from stories. This piece that showed up in email that talked about her actual experiences was fascinating. She's a wonderful writer, and it was in her own voice. Third and final sort of crack in knowledge that should have us wondering if something big is going on here is the Wikipedia. Wikipedia is a fantastic site, and it sounds like a completely ridiculous experiment, but it's worked. Wikipedia is a bottom-up encyclopedia. Encyclopedias traditionally are where knowledge goes to live. The encyclopedists in the 17th century were defining knowledge. These were the authorities that you went to. They were coalescing it all in between covers. Wikipedia, anybody can create an entry. Anybody who has access to the web. And if you're reading an entry and you think it's wrong or one-sided, you want to fix it up, go ahead. One button click, and you're now typing into the encyclopedia. So this would sound like it must be bound to draw all the worst elements of the web. This would be a magnet for misinformation, disinformation, for lies, slander, gossip, this tinfoil hat ideas. Turns out it's actually pretty good. It's 1 million articles so far, and generally pretty good, and it's only going to get better. That's a big change in what constitutes the authority of knowledge. So knowledge began, as you know, with the Greeks, at least that's generally where you trace it back to. This is the Agora, this is the idealized view of it, and this is how it actually looks now. Somewhere in between is the truth, and in the Agora, anybody could stand up and argue for how the city-state should be directed. Matters of life and death, these bodily decisions. Am I going to die in a war? Am I going to have enough food to eat? What's going to happen to my children? Anybody could stand up, where anybody means any property-owning adult white male. But you know, within that constriction, you know, anybody. Birthplace of democracy. So, burning question arises. Here we have people who are arguing different sides of an issue. Which ones of these should we believe? What are beliefs worthy of being believed? And that would be knowledge. Knowledge was born out of this bodily involvement, this context, where you were at issue and your children were at issue. So Plato, as I'm sure you know, said, well, let's see, what's knowledge? Knowledge is not just true belief, but it's justified true belief, stuff you're justified in believing. And that began 2,500 years of inquiry into, well, what constitutes justification? And over time, generally, the range of knowledge got narrower and narrower. The range of justification got tighter and tighter. The stranglehold on knowledge got tighter and tighter. So it began with, well, you knew about the stuff you needed to know in order to do your craft or to guide the ship of state. That was what knowledge was about. And it got narrowed. It was stuff that you could prove through logic. And it got narrowed. It was stuff you could prove or know through faith. It got narrowed. It was stuff that you knew through math. Until 1600s, we get this guy, René Descartes, who narrowed knowledge down to a single sentence that even God couldn't trick him about. I think, therefore I am. And while Descartes then used that as a foundation to expand what we know, nevertheless, this extremely narrow rationalistic view of what knowledge is has stayed with us. So even Descartes stopped thinking 1650 and was no more. Nevertheless, after that, we still have much of his attitude towards knowledge embedded in us. So what started out as lively discussions among concerned citizens about how their state would proceed and what would happen to them as embodied individuals, that's been narrowed and narrowed and narrowed until what constitutes knowledge, it's an anorexic view of knowledge, where experts in increasingly small slices have authority over some segment of a discipline, and increasingly abstracted from the human context. Well, Aristotle was the first to enunciate the shape of knowledge. He discerned it. Didn't invent it, he discerned it. And he was asking a question like, what does it mean to know what a robin is? And decided that there are 10 categories of knowledge about anything, basically 10 questions you can ask about anything. But he was particularly interested in one, which is, what is it? Because that's the fundamental question. So he said, well, you know, if you don't know that a robin is a bird, you really don't know what a robin is. Knowledge has something to do with ordering, classifying, categorizing. It has to do with lumping and splitting. So to know that a robin is a bird is to put it together, to lump it with all the other birds, and to split it off from those other birds by how it's different from them. What makes something a bird is that it's a feathered biped. You know, if it's got two legs and you got feathers, you're a bird. That is a way of both gathering together and splitting apart. And that strategy of knowing what something is by seeing what it's like and how it's different from other things has lasted for 2,500 years. It's an incredibly powerful way of comprehending large, complex things like the universe. It's amazingly powerful. Now, I've drawn this here. It looks like a tree that we're very familiar with, org charts and the like, an inverted tree, the roots at the bottom, but a branching structure. Aristotle actually didn't picture it that way. It took 500 years for somebody to do that, and that was Porphyry, a Syrian philosopher, who actually first drew Aristotle's categories as a tree, represented them graphically as a tree. But that tree-like thinking has stuck with us, firmly embedded in our brains. There are two premises of Aristotle's that want to mention really briefly because they bear directly on what's happening in the digital world. The first is the notion, as I said at the beginning, that knowledge ends where miscellany begins, where the miscellaneous begins. So, for example, you do your laundry. And you have everything lumped together. It's one big lump. And then you engage in the basic act of categorizing, which is to split and then lump and split and lump. So we split this into a set of lumps. Shirts, which are lumped together, even though the green one's different than the red one, and socks, even though they're different colors, different weights. So we're lumping and splitting. This is how we manage in our lives. This is how we organize and understand our world. But then you get to a point where you're putting away, say, your socks, and this is my sock drawer. This sock drawer has no organizing principle. It is miscellaneous. I could, I suppose, organize it by weight or color or something like that, but I don't. From Aristotle's point of view, and Greek point of view, there's no knowledge possible of this sock drawer because it's too miscellaneous. Knowledge ends at my sock drawer. It ends at the miscellaneous. Second premise of Aristotle and the Greeks in general is that, well, of course, knowledge and the world are the same shape. Knowledge is of the world, and if it were a different shape or order or organization of the world, then it wouldn't really be knowledge of the world. It would be a mistake about the world. So knowledge and the world are essentially the same in how they're organized. Which brings us straight to Melville Dewey, the creator of the Dewey Decimal System, 1876, he published it. This was an attempt by Dewey to organize knowledge so that libraries, the geography of libraries, could represent, have the same geography as the landscape of knowledge. So we'd cluster stuff together by topic. And Dewey came up with 10 categories, each have 100 numbers, and within them, all of human knowledge can be arrayed. So if you look at the 200, which is religion and theology, you have to get down to 296. There are 88 of the numbers, of the 100 numbers in that category, are assigned to Christian topics. 296, Judaism, one number for Judaism. 297, Islam and religions originating in it, one number for Islam. And Buddhists, to the right of the decimal point. They didn't make it into the whole numbers. So something's peculiar about this. It's clearly a reflection of Dewey's somewhat naive, he was just out of college when he did this, a somewhat naive view of what the structure of knowledge is. It's highly based in his cultural context, a cultural context that in a pluralistic society we no longer hold to. So why don't the owners of the Dewey Decimal System, the OCLC, fix it? These are reasonable people. These are not people who are out to enforce some religious point of view. Why don't they fix it? It's tweaked all the time. And there's a very good reason why they don't fix it. It's because books are in the real world. In order to fix it, you could not find enough razor blades. You'd have to send out thousands of librarians with razor blades to scrape the white ink off the backs of the books and then write in the new classification numbers. And as soon as they were done updating it to get rid of this Christian bias, you'd start hearing from, say, the Sunnis and the Shiites, who are arguing over whether they should be at the same level. And what are the Baha'is doing there? And the Jews for Jesus and the Scientologists, what level should they be at? You would have a never-ending series of arguments in all the categories. And you'd have librarians all the time going out doing nothing but scraping white ink off the backs of spines. This is not a soluble problem. It is not the case that there is a right Dewey Decimal System that will satisfy everybody across all cultures for all time, or even for an instant. It is not a soluble problem. The problem is that there is no such thing as a universal taxonomy, and this is despite what Aristotle would have thought. So now we're in the process of digitizing everything. That's a big change, and I think you can see it as being a third order in addition to the first two. I think it's maybe useful, but you'll let me know, to think about this as having of us as having three orders of organization. And then the first two are very familiar, and they're, I think, well symbolized by the Bettman Archive, which, as you know, is the nation's most prestigious collection, perhaps, of historic photographs. 11 million photographs. Bill Gates bought the Bettman in the 90s, and in 2001 he moved it from where it was melting, literally melting in Manhattan, to a cave, a set of caverns, 220 feet underground in central Pennsylvania, limestone quarries. The Bettman consists of two caverns, a front one and a back one. In the back one, you get the first order of organization, where you actually organize physical things. The photographs in the filing cabinets. It goes on forever, by the way. This is a hugely long cavern. It's being lowered to -2 degrees over time in order to keep it preserved. So you actually have to bundle up. There's a climate change involved in going into this place. So here's the first order of organization where the things themselves are organized. In the second order, it's the front cavern, which is where the card catalogs are. Very familiar card catalogs. And in the second order, what you do is you take a physical representation of the metadata, that is information, about the objects that you're filing in the first order. The books on the shelf, second order, is the card catalog. You move those separate from the books and you put them into, say, a card catalog where you have many advantages, including the fact that you can organize the card catalog differently than you organize the books on the shelves. Right? So Dewey organizes by topic and the card catalog may be alphabetical by author. Also, I've been told there's something like 560 miles of shelves in the Library of Congress. That's a lot of walking. It's a lot faster to walk through the card catalog. So there are obvious and big advantages to using the second order scheme. It works really well. But now, as we move the actual contents online, as the information itself is moving online, we can ask a really important question, which is, okay, now, what can we do easily with digital information that the real world makes hard, that the real world requires you to send out people with razor blades for? What can we do with this opportunity? And I'd like to point briefly at four different changes. The first is that the basic act of lumping and splitting in the real world means that you make a decision about where you're going to put your socks. Are you going through your laundry and are you going to put this pair into the sock pile or into the shirt pile? You can't do both. That's the fundamental thing about lumping and splitting. The stuff only goes in one lump. So if you had a real-world store and you had a new digital camera and you wanted to put it somewhere, very likely you would categorize it under photographic equipment. If this were a website, if you're doing this online, absolutely you wouldn't just do it in one category. You do it in as many categories as possible. It's to your advantage to have it show up every place that somebody might be looking for digital cameras. You can have a leaf on many branches. The fundamental act of lumping and splitting has just been violated. Second of all, in the real world, in first and second orders, what you want is neat classification schemes. Dewey is very neat and simple. Right? It's a branching structure. You want to have it neat and clean and clear and unambiguous, whereas on the web or in other digital environments, you absolutely want as much mess as possible. You want to have this camera linked all over the place. The more links, the more value. Messiness is a virtue on the web. Third, in the real world organization, first and second order, the person who owns the information generally owns the organization of that information because they're moving the thing around, so it better be the owner. So if you went into a clothing store and you said, you know what, I'd like to see all of the clothing in this store that's in my size. I'm just going to grab it here. I'm going to make a big pile of my stuff. You'll be frog-walked out of the store before you got more than three items in your hand. You can't do that because the store owns the organization of that information. Online, absolutely. Not only you should demand to be able to order that information the way that you want because the owner of the information no longer owns the organization of that information. So, for example, this is a site called Newegg. It's one of many online stores that lets you do this. When you go there and you look for digital cameras, they will show you what they think, they'll show you their preferred order, which happens to feature the camera they're pushing this week. And that's fine. Sure, why not? But if you look on the left-hand side, there's a place for you to say what you care about. I don't care what type of memory stick, but I do care about the manufacturer and the number of megapixels. Click that, and now the store reorganizes itself around your needs, around your interests. You own the organization of that store, if you want to. We take this for granted now. And Amazon's a fantastic example of this, by the way. It will very quickly get to the point, if you're doing online shopping, you're not allowed to do this, it will seem like a very old-fashioned online store. The fourth of these changes is that not only do the users get to organize the information, but the users now can contribute to the information. And in fact, sometimes that's the only way to get the information in. So, for example, we will all have tens of thousands of digital photos on our hard drives within the next few years, certainly within the next 10 years. And when you upload from your camera onto your computer, you will see a listing of file names that's closed. It's computer gibberish. It's DSC0002.jpg. Well, that's fine, except in 10 years, when you're trying to find the picture you took 10 years ago of Aunt Millie on the beach, you're not really going to remember what DSC00 number it was. This is going to be more and more of a problem. There are various attempts to solve it, but one of them is really interesting. It's called social tagging. And the idea is that, and this is now being done at least occasionally at some conferences, they take the conference photos, they put them up on a website, and they invite conference attendees to browse through them, and when they recognize somebody, particularly themselves, because egotism certainly counts, type in the name. And so you distribute the task of tagging thousands of photos across a group that's at least as large. And now you can start to get this stuff tagged. In terms of personal photographs, as our photographs on our hard drives become more and more networked, as we're sharing them with relatives and friends, the same sort of social tagging will take place. So now we have users who, just in this one little example, actually get to add to the richness of these objects by putting in their own information, in this case, identifying people and events. So I think that this means, and in a minute I want to turn to examples from the web of how this is playing out, but I think what this means overall is that for many people who are information architects or they're librarians of one sort or another, they're in the business of organizing information and helping people find it, that there's a switch. Rather than trying simply to build a single universal tree of categories into which everything will fit, instead, we should also be thinking about ponds, building ponds that are filled with rich information objects that have so many different ways of being found that users 50 or 100 years from now who are doing research will still be able to find what they want even though we didn't anticipate what they were looking for. And that's the challenge. So, for example, going from a library card, which is packed full of data, to enriching that with as much information about that book and about the information as possible, including the author's, I'm making this up, okay, but including the author's biography, the other books the author has written, of course, the books that were written about this book that mention it, which is happening on Amazon right now, by the way, the author's social world, the author's friends and relatives and other people that he knew, because we may want to search for him that way. The content of the book itself needs to be part of this information packet. We want to be able to search through the content to find it because we want to remember, what was that book that used this phrase? And I'll just say in passing, what this means, for those of you who care, is that the difference between metadata and data, between the tag and the content, it's gone. The content now is a tag. So the content itself needs to be there. The links from the web, what everybody else on the web is saying over time dynamically, is also should be part of this information object. And yes, you might as well add the kitchen sink and make sure that you make it really easy for your users to add their own information to this packet. You want stuff as rich as possible because people are not going to find it by going through a taxonomy, at least not very often. They're going to find it by searching for the data around the object. So in this world, I mean, if that's what's happening, if these four sorts of changes are happening, then what's the world going to look like? And I think you can get actually a pretty good glimpse of it because it's happening already on the web. So I want to start with what is actually a negative example, and I'm going to apologize for, because I'm going to pick on Kenmore, but for two reasons. The first is we're Kenmore, happy Kenmore customers, so I can give them a plug. And the second is that it's random. There's so many sites like this. Almost all commercial sites are like this. They're just truly random. So I want to tell you a story about 2 years ago when my wife and I were looking for a new washer-dryer. We had it narrowed down to Maytag versus Kenmore. And so I went to the Kenmore site. And at that point, what did you see? You saw a little flash advertisement before you got to the site. And what it said was, introducing a revolutionary new washer that will change the way you think about laundry. There's no audio, but that's the voices I hear. Sort of Walter Cronkite marries James Earl Jones. So why am I seeing this? I don't want to think about laundry. It's the whole point of fixing any of these things. I don't want to think about laundry. But somebody, a marketing person, figured, okay, we can message him real good now. So then you click through and you get to the site, and it's completely professional, typical, good-looking sort of site, totally without value. Not a shred of value in it. Kenmore, smart, stylish, simple. Yeah, it's just marketing. It's alliteration, so it's got to be marketing. And then a set of things you can do. You can click on Kenmore Promise, Kenmore Elite, trust your Kenmore IQ. That's a quiz to see if I have sufficiently absorbed the Kenmore marketing messages. Well, meanwhile, I'm trying to buy something from them. I want to buy a washing machine. I want to know if their washing machine is going to fit in the hole I just cut in my counter, and they're giving me smart, stylish, and simple. Well, you can get that information. It's 8 clicks in, but you can get it. And there it is. Very straightforward, great information, they stand behind it, that's great. It's as if they're embarrassed about it. It's as if they're ashamed of this. Totally typical of commercial sites. So I told a little lie. The little lie was that I didn't go to the Kenmore site because I knew that's what it was going to be. It didn't occur to me. So instead I went to what is every company's homepage, which is Google. Thank you very much. Yes, it's Google. I Googled Kenmore, Maytag, and discussion. I got to thathomesite.com, which is a site that's just discussion forums around household items. You type in the model number, and I found this thread, this discussion thread. Somebody says, anybody been looking at this model? And sure enough, this guy named Jim writes in and says, yeah, I have been. I looked at some competitors. We got the Kenmore. We're very happy with it. The dryer's noisier than the washer, which I hadn't ever thought about. I dried a queen-size bedspread in it. Again, I hadn't thought about it, but it's good to know. It dried great, he says. The interesting thing to me is this guy, Jim, I believe, but if I went to the Kenmore site and it said, best of all, dries bedspreads like a dream, I wouldn't have believed it. But Jim, I believe. And it's really important to ask why that's the case. Well, he continues. He says, I'm using up my old detergents. Again, hadn't thought of that, finishes up. He says, but oh, the buzzer on both machines. Sure wish they were chimes or something. Because it turns out the Dunn buzzer on these washer-dryer things, so loud, car alarms going off. Neighbor's cat hair is coming out. It's incredibly loud. So, this is actual knowledge. This is not stuff I'd find out any other way. This is knowledge that is embedded in the human context, how acute our hearing is, how big our houses are, how far apart our houses are from us, how important it is for us to hear about our laundry. If this were a smoke alarm, the fact that it was so loud would be great. We have to know a lot about it. You have to be embedded in the human context to know that a laundry alarm can be too loud. So why do I believe Jim? And by the way, if I'd gone to the Kenmore store, I will guarantee you they would never have said, hey, you want to hear the buzzer on this baby? Just not going to come up. So this stuff only emerges out of the human context. So why do I believe Jim? Why is this knowledge to me? First of all, because he speaks in a human voice. He makes jokes, he misspells, his grammar's not that great, he seems to be balanced, doesn't seem to be shilling for Kenmore. Could I be wrong? Could this be a clever marketing droid from Kenmore? Theoretically, yes. No, I'm not wrong. This is a real human being. So voice is a powerful authority in this new world. And that's remarkable. Second reason is it's not just Jim, this is part of a discussion thread. So you read down, there's another 10 messages saying, oh yeah, that buzzer's a killer, here's what I did about it. Just have the installer snip the wires. And the installer writes in and says, no, we'll get fired, don't even ask us. There's the authorities in the voice and the authorities in the conversation. This is the opposite of think about the encyclopedias from the 1600s. This is the opposite of that sort of authority of knowledge. You continue reading this thread, by the way, and you come across, your front loaders leave more or less lint on clothes than top loaders. Okay? This person named Rinso, which is a little disturbing, I will admit. Rinso writes in and says, dear Karen, because of the difference in free tumbling in water as opposed to being beaten by sharp blades, there's a physicist of lint who hangs out at this site and can't wait to jump in. There's expertise for you. There's expertise embedded in the world. So if voice and conversation are important elements of authority that are emerging in the new world of knowledge, then we have to talk about weblogs. So I'm going to. Weblogs, weblogs are blogs, they're daily journals, they are in reverse chronological order generally. That is, the new entry pushes down the old one. They're incredibly easy to update. You just type into a box and it gets published on the web. All that's true. It's not at the heart of blogs. It doesn't explain why there is so much interest in them. And I believe there's genuine interest. I think ultimately blogs are really interesting and people care about them because they are places where we get to speak in our own voice about the things that matter to us, and there's persistence. There's no real persistence to email, none to IM, none to telephone calls. There are to blogs. We write there every day. And you can come back as often as you want, and the more you read, the more you're going to know me. Weblogs are selves. That's why they matter. That's why they matter to the bloggers. That's why friendships spring up among bloggers so quickly and easily, because we already know each other. Weblogs are the way that we are constructing ourselves in this new public. We've never had a new simultaneous public before, simultaneous with the real world. Now we do, and the first thing we fill a public with is selves. And how do you do that? There has to be voice, there has to be persistence. Weblogs. We're writing ourselves into existence on the web, one blog entry at a time. But they're not just people talking about, oh, breakfast and their cat and why they hate their teachers and the rest of that. Of course, we are talking about that too. But more important, weblogs are conversations. They are done in response frequently to other weblogs. This is Doc Searles, a well-known weblogger. This is his site. Notice all the blue underlined text. You can see that much of what Doc writes about are responses to other people's weblogs, and they to him. And you get these webs of conversation going. On the right-hand side is Doc's blog roll. That's a list of weblogs that Doc finds interesting and thinks you will too. So here's Doc, who's saying, go, here are great links. Go somewhere else. Go away from my site for a while. Here's something you'll find interesting also. This is it's a little act of selflessness. It's totally common. This is how the web got built, by people linking away from themselves. It's totally common in the world of weblogs. You don't even think about, oh, I'm going to send somebody away. That's how your blog has value. So here's a guy who says, click here, go away from me. A little act of generosity, the exact opposite of the Kenmore site. Commercial sites don't get this. They're still interested in attracting sticky eyeballs, the most disgusting way of talking about your customers ever invented, and they don't even recognize it. So another point about weblogs that makes them important is that they're written badly. We write them every day. Some of us, the more unemployed of us, write several times a day. And if you're going to be a really good writer and polish everything you write, you're never going to get it done. You're never going to be out, your blog's never going to get published. So you have to be willing to write badly in public. Now, many of the bloggers are really good writers. Nevertheless, they're not as good as when they're writing over the course of weeks and doing something for print publication. You have to be willing to write badly. Two effects of that. One is that we get to see you a little bit more at home, a little bit more relaxed, a little bit less formal and protected, moving the line of public and private. The second thing that happens, I think, is more interesting, which is there's an ethos of forgiveness that develops. Your readers know you're writing quickly. So they don't bother writing in and saying, oh, typo, ha ha. Of course, it's a weblog. Of course there are typos in it. Of course you say things that you regret later. It's a weblog. That's the whole point. This culture of forgiveness is hugely important, and it helps explain why weblogs are able to pull people together in the way that most published writing doesn't. We've already forgiven each other. That's an act of intimacy. So what happens when there's no separation between author and work, when the line between public and private is being moved, when we see the value of the contents of what you're writing as a large part of that value being pointing away from yourself, as opposed to trying to encapsulate content, value in your content, when there's an ethos of forgiveness, when voice is connecting us, that affects knowledge. And one of the ways of talking about this is to go back to the old objectivity-subjectivity split. Now, objectivity tries to show us the world as it is, as if we weren't there observing it. Subjectivity shows us our world as it matters to us. Virtues in both, of course. When it comes to knowledge, however, subjectivity's gotten the short end of the stick. Subjectivity doesn't get any respect. Objectivity, that's where knowledge is. Knowledge, objectivity, and facts, quite a trio. Subjectivity, it's different for each person, so it can't be knowledge. It's too miscellaneous. So here's what I think is happening. We have weblogs that are in conversation with one another across time and space. Let's say your topic that you're interested in is forgiveness. Okay? Now, I could send you to some authoritative works on the topic, perhaps. You could go to an encyclopedia. You could find an expert. Or you could go to Google. And you could Google forgiveness. You might even add the word blogs, but Google likes blogs. But there's an ugly sentence just in terms of the sonic sound of it. Google likes blogs, so you're likely to get some blogs when you do the search. You Google for forgiveness, maybe you'll find my friend ACMA, A-K-M-A. He's a theologian at a small seminary outside of Chicago. He wrote some brilliant stuff about forgiveness. People responded to him. So you go read ACMA's stuff, and you'll see links going in and out. People looked at what ACMA said, other bloggers, and said, well, that's really interesting, but I think it's right, I think it's wrong, I like this, I didn't like that, here's how it looks from a Buddhist point of view, I'm a Jew, here's how it looks from a Jewish point of view, and the person over here responds in her blog to that person over there, responds to that person, and this messy web of links that nobody could ever traverse emerges. And if you go and you start with ACMOR or any of the links and start following them, you'll get multiple views, subjective views, about what forgiveness means. And not only that, you'll get them in conversation with one another. And we've never, ever had that before. And that's a type of multi-subjectivity that's giving subjectivity some of the heft that expert-controlled, authoritative objectivity has reserved for itself. And there's an enormous eruption of joy on the web that we are able to do that. Wikipedia, remember Wikipedia from the beginning? It's a very constrained medium. They're very careful. It tries for objectivity. Nevertheless, even there, there's a tremendous upsurge of joy that we are able to do this. We are able to write our own encyclopedia. We've wrested the encyclopedia out of the hands of the experts, out of the hands of the Britannicas. Nothing wrong with Britannica. That's theirs. This is ours. We haven't had that before. So what's the shape of knowledge? Trees are in trouble. Trees are always going to be useful. They're an amazing way of compressing thought. They are incredibly useful for traversing large, complex subject matters. But the dream of a universal tree of knowledge, of a set of categories into which we can then slot things, that dream, I believe, is dead. And instead, knowledge is beginning to look more like this. This tangle, this messy, organic tangle that's growing bottom up, that's viney, that's dark, that's ambiguous, that nobody can ever traverse entirely, that whose value comes from the fact that it cannot be encapsulated, that it's busted out of the vine, out of the bonds, that it's growing without any plan, that it's growing through links and through human interest, around things that matter to us, the things that matter to us as embodied individuals. This is so far from Dewey that it's unimaginable. This is the reaction against 2,500 years of attempts to provide knowledge through constructing trees, through trees of categories. Now, Aristotle, way at the beginning, believed that knowledge was only knowledge if it reflected the way the world looks, that if knowledge, actually knowledge and world are the same organizing principles. And what I want to suggest by way of ending is that's exactly what we see happening here, that this tangled, viney, inchoate mass that can't ever be articulated fully or traversed fully or contained fully, that this is a better representation of our world than any category tree could ever be. And that furthermore, that this is the only way of understanding our world which allows us to live in a pluralistic, diverse world together. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was provocative and entertaining and thoroughly delightful. And I'm glad the pictures were finally available. That made a big difference, too. We're now going to hear very briefly from our two panelists. We'll give them just a few minutes each to respond, and then we'll turn to you for questions. Bob, would you go first?
Sure. It's hard to know where to begin with that, whether one should start with the leaves or with the roots. I think I want to just respond with two practical illustrations, I think, of the kind of thing that David was talking about, and only perhaps in a context of the agency that I'm familiar with, the Institute of Museum and Library Services. We, along with many other federal agencies, foundations, and other funders, have supported the creation of a lot of digital content over the past several years. And as you mentioned at the beginning, it's going pretty well. There's a lot of stuff out there. And what we have discovered in the feedback we get from the projects that we have funded is that people use this stuff in ways we never anticipated that they would. They don't come to it through the card catalog to find the you know, a structured, systematic kind of approach to knowledge, but rather they encounter it serendipitously. Perhaps through Google, but in links from all sorts of other kinds of approaches. And what they do is they capture that those resources and bring them to their desktop, and they reorganize them in ways that meet their needs and interests. They repurpose the content, which museums and libraries and archives and other cultural institutions have preserved in very specific and structured kinds of ways. And they are not guided by the ways in which we have preserved and carefully organized and presented and sometimes interpreted for their use, but rather they put it together the way that makes sense to them. What we have found in response to that is that they're doing that in the digital world, but the digital world, the digital environment for cultural resources and learning resources doesn't answer all needs. People, you know, you can get copies of the Declaration of Independence in a variety of different forms and formats. You can buy it for a couple of bucks out on the mall if you want to, and yet people still stand in line in the sun for a long time to go in to see the Charters of Freedom. There's a reason why they do that. The same thing holds true of, you know, Renoir's Afternoon of the Boating Party, or, you know, pick any object you want. The fact that you have ready access to it in digital form does not mean that you don't also want to, on occasion, have access to the authentic, the physical. And what we are finding is that people are finding these things from museums and libraries and archives and other kinds of sources. The Bettman Archive is another example. And that they, when they want to find the authentic, they all of a sudden encounter a host of barriers that they did not anticipate. You know, if they're finding things and repurposing them for their own interests in the field of, broadly speaking, American history, and they take something from, they take an object from the National Museum of American History and a document from the National Archives and a photograph or an audio clip from the Library of Congress's collections and put them together to solve their own needs, and then they come to try to find the authentic, they discover that there are all kinds of impediments to that access. They're housed in different places. They're accessed through different processes and procedures. It's easier to get to the object if it's on display in the National Museum than it might be to get to the document, which is in the stacks of the National Archives. They might have to take the metro and the bus out to Archives 2 in College Park to get to it. And my point is that we need to think of ways to reduce those barriers in the real world as we have in the digital world. I think I could go on at great length about that, and I better stop before I take up too much time. I wanted to make one other initial comment, and that is your point about users contributing to the information. We actually have some really splendid examples of this in local history collections and libraries and museums, where we have put up a photograph and say, "Who is this?" You know, in the context of a little and foster through that process a really interesting local community dialogue about not only who might be pictured in that photograph, but what's the context of it, what's its significance to the community, and draws in and really creates a whole new sense of community by engaging the audience, to use one of our constituents' favorite way of talking about people who use our resources. So I think that just highlights the kind of thing I think you're talking about.
I'd like to ask David a question. Libraries are watching all of this going on right now, and libraries tend to have a feet in both the present and in the future, because we're concerned about 50 years from now, looking back at 2004, what are people going to want to know about what was going on in this world in this time? What do you think libraries should be doing now to capture all of this stuff that's going on, this messy web that's out there?
It can't ever be done fully. Mm-hmm. There are only incremental steps toward this. There's always going to be some request. The researcher wants to locate all books, not only written in German, that have more than one author, one of whom has a PhD, but who has red hair. And you just won't have that bit of information there. But trying to add as much information to the objects that are there, however that can be done. And user input is one, but libraries know a huge amount starting out on their own. The objects have to be, the information objects have to be open-ended because you never know what people are going to want to add to it later. You have a remarkable resource in a database of books. That's not a bad place to start. And those, over time, those book catalogs have already been enhanced with more and more information. The adding of, as the content gets digitized, that turns out to be, not surprisingly, a hugely important additional bit of data that's in the bundle. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't have a good system. I don't have a good systematic answer, but being open to non-systematic answers, I think, is a big part of it.
In addition to describing these things and adding to those descriptions, where the Library of Congress is just starting a web archiving project. I mean, actually capturing this stuff and saving it for the future. And is that something you think libraries should be doing? Is it another? Does it belong somewhere else?
Well, I think it's a great thing for somebody to be doing. As you, I'm sure you know, Brewster Kahle is with the Wayback Machine has been attempting to do something like that as well. The issue, of course, is that the web is dynamic, and even if it weren't, Google just upped the number of pages that it is indexed to 8 billion, basically doubled its size, but we have to suspect that that's still just a fraction of the available material. But no, I think it would be, I'm delighted to hear that. Would be a huge benefit not only to the existing community, but historically, tremendous value in that.
Thank you, panelists. Thank you, David. Now we're going to turn to the audience and to the viewers and hear some of your questions. There is a microphone in the back that will be brought to you, and we'd like you to speak in the microphone so we can capture your comments. Let me begin with a question from one of the viewers who asks, can you give words of reassurance to historians who have depended on written records in one form or another? What would you say to historians who use paper documents? And any one of you. Derek, maybe you have a thought about that.
Actually, while you were talking, I did have a historian issue. It's a site called Zeitenwende from Germany, which is always semi-functional, but the idea of the site is quite extraordinary, I think. It is for people to tell and show their testimony about the history of Germany over the last 100 years, and it's to tell them from their point of view and not from the point of view of a official historical record, but they have to be able to document what they're saying with whatever evidence they have digitized. And you travel into this map of the memory of Germany via datelines and geography so that you can actually choose different periods and even different weeks in the year and in different parts of a city, different areas. And you can navigate in it and also, as you said, in some ways, by different kinds of taxonomies, different kinds of orders. I believe that history, in fact, has itself changed very much under the influence of people who have been here. By the way, Fernand Braudel is one. History has moved from the sort of imposed order of the large events and the big characters and the big people to the small details and what were the core, the core motivation of the life of a village, of the life of a certain type of profession, for example. And I think that to that extent, the new kind of multifaceted, the diamond kind of history writing brings something more to historical process. But I also believe that, just as you were talking about the authority of the actual work of art or the actual book that was published, I believe also that a certain kind of opinion making in history is going to become much more valued than in the past, particularly when we abandon the illusion of objectivity. I wanted to ask you this question. I want to respond to this question. The history of objectivity comes along with subjectivity. The history of the private comes along with the public. The republic was invented to protect private property because it was the res publica, the public thing, and then people living in it had their private property. When people learned to read and write, they internalized, they literally appropriated language and internalized consciousness and privatized it, literally closed the door on it. The founder of our private consciousness is Prometheus. Prometheus is standing attached to a rock. He has no power, but the power that he has is to close his mind on a secret that Zeus wants to know, to have and doesn't get. That's the beginning of the Western mind. The Western mind is challenged by electricity, and all this content is not anymore divided into objective, subjective, and the objective of the past we have brilliantly been shown Aristotelian categories don't really work very well anymore. We don't have any real ground. We move from the solid to the liquid. We're in a post-Galilean moment right now, literally. Galileo was supposed to say the world, there was a solidity to the world that God couldn't touch. That was the whole idea. Now we realize, in fact, we're moving from a solid world to a liquid world. But my question to you would be, in the multijectivity or the polyjectivity that you were referring to, isn't the role of the blog, isn't the blog the first example or the first image of a connected identity as opposed to a private identity?
I think identities have always been connected. They've always been what we do in public in relation to others. And the notion of a hardened self that's independent of the world, and very much a traditional American ideal, in fact, of the...
And Greek.
We've taken up the idea of fierce independence, I think, and self-reliance more than most cultures have. And that, I think, we're seeing that fail. Yeah. It's failing in the face that... of a new, medium, where you get to build, everything that's there is built on purpose. There's nothing in the web space that wasn't built by someone or some company consisting of people in order to do something, in order to be connected to somebody else. So the selves that we are able to build and project on the web are necessarily, and not only necessarily, but unavoidably social. In a way that I actually think ourselves always were, but we were able to avoid it. On the web, why are you there unless you in some way care about connecting with other people? If you don't, then you're not on the web. That's fine. You don't have to. So the illusory notion that selves are sort of hardened M&M-like substances that exist essentially independent from everybody else cannot be support. You can't be on the web and support that idea very consistently anyway. It's a link. Web only exists, literally only exists because of the links.
But the blog,
links are primary.
The blog, more than the web, contains the expression, the so-called diary published online, and that's one thing. And you said that's not very important. In fact, that isn't very important. But that what is important is you have a list of the things that that person who has published is interested in looking at. Joe blog, your blog. You have a list. We know where to go. But more than everything else. Is that fact that comes with your network of people asking questions and referring. And this is this also messy extension of your own identity by the people who respond to you. That's what I'm talking about as a new form of identity that we hadn't known before, for which we didn't have an image. We always knew about the self and the private self and everything in philosophy and novels and, on the stage. But now we have a very different kind of relationship setting up.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think what blogs in particular, because much of that had been happening on the web anyway, what blogs add to it is the persistence. So links have always been the fundamental matter of the web, more than the content. Without the links, there is literally no web. Blogs give individuals a place in which to attach those links with persistence, and that is, I think, a significant change.
Now to the audience here and find out if you have questions. Lots of questions. Carolyn, we need a microphone here.
You've been talking a lot about issues of identity and culture, and you've been rooted in your conversation in Western culture. And I find myself wondering, since we know that identity gets constructed, at least this has been the sort of common assumption, it gets constructed in different cultures in different kinds of ways. And I wonder if you have any cross-cultural information or interpretation about how blogs get used differently in different places. And I'm just wondering, and I don't know if this is, we think of Japanese culture, certain Asian cultures, as being more collective in terms of how you construct identity and where the whole notion of the group or the collective is much better acknowledged than it has been in Western culture. So I find myself wondering, well, are there Japanese blogs? And what would they look like? And what would the conversations be like? And what would the constructions of identity look like, since we know the starting point of identity is different from the West?
A wonderful question to which I have a miserable answer. So, yes, it seems like it must be the case that, just as you suggest, that weblogs are going to be essentially different in different cultures, even though they're the same form and they may be using the same software, but that doesn't matter. It's the social role of them. And it seems like that must be the case. And I'm certain that it is. And there's a field that's growing. It's sort of just been named, which is internet sociology. I'm at the Harvard Berkman Center this year, and there are a couple of people there who are very involved in that sort of research. Ethan Zuckerman, for example, has a special interest in African blogs and the internet in Africa. It's an enormously important question that needs careful attention, and I have no answer.
Great. Let's have a question right here from this audience, and we'll move to the viewers.
A question for David Weinberger. A question is, the Usenet was around 10 years ago. We had Deja to index it. It's pretty much dead. It seems like there aren't too many more postings. Any thoughts on the Usenet or Deja?
Well, Usenet isn't quite dead. Google owns it. Owns Deja, not Usenet. All right, so they're indexing. Usenet is internet, the original internet discussion forums, and there are something like 70,000 of them still. Something like that. Google has been indexing them for the past 4 or 5 years since they bought Deja News. So they're still, and they seem, from what I can see from the site, it looks like they're beginning to sort of push on that a little bit again also. So there's still some life in those. They were, and still are. I actually use them quite frequently. They're really valuable. With 70,000 topics, the topics get fairly specific. As the volume of users grew, the number of topics splintered in order to be able to keep them relatively focused. So they actually turn out to be quite useful ways of posing questions and getting answers. They're used for other things as well, including, famously, flame wars. They've since the web came along, they have fallen into, they're not as central to the internet experience as they once were, because they're not terribly user friendly in the way that some websites can be. But they're still kicking, and they still serve a purpose.
Thank you. I'm now going to read a question from a viewer in Providence, Rhode Island, who asks, what advantages do blogs have over more traditional forms of information gathering, and what types of regulations will be put in place to ensure blogs are rich in content and worth reading?
Would you are you thoughtfully listening? I'm going to answer it again. They're distinguished from other information gathering media in that they're not primarily, often they're not primarily about information gathering. Often they are primarily about people connecting with other people, writing about what matters to them in response to this community of people who are reading them. It's quite a thrill to be read. That's again a type of intimacy, to actually have your stuff be read by people you don't know, whether it's 100,000 or 500,000, like some of the more popular blogs, or 4 or 5, which is more typical as you go down the tail of 5 to 10 million people writing weblogs, to be read is an act of intimacy. It's not an act of information sharing. So what are the controls put in place for making sure that blogs are of high quality? None. It's really, really important, despite recent FCC findings. The control on weblogs is primarily if other people find you interesting. That's the motive. That's what pulls you through yet another entry. And it doesn't have to be a lot of people. It can be a handful of people.
There is something quite remarkable about getting an email message that says, you've been blogged. It's remarkable. Let's see. Are there questions over here? Beck and Peg.
For both Robert and David. And my question really focuses on education. We've talked a lot now about libraries and trees of knowledge and so forth. How do you see the field of education maybe changing as a result of the blogging? And also for Robert, one of the reasons I was interested in this is because of your talking about museums. And, you know, museums have been used more than ever now in education. So how does that whole thing get put together?
Hmm. You want me to go first?
Absolutely.
Well, I think the really, in the standpoint of education, I would actually try to recast your question in terms of not education but learning. The power of the blog is the way it empowers the development of, in an organic sort of way, of self-selecting communities of interest. And that can be done at every age level, above a certain threshold of being able to manipulate the mechanics that's required. And I think there's a substantial potential for really supporting the transfer of knowledge, learning, at all stages of learning, in all stages of life, by the creation or establishment or development of these kind of self-selecting communities of interest that dissolves the geographic barriers that have been the focus of education. I mean, education has, until very recently, been very definitely geocentric, place-centered. And now I think we face the prospect of having a sort of a global interconnectedness that allows people and empowers people to explore well beyond their previous limitations in terms of geography. Exactly how that will play out, I have no idea. But I think we're in for a really interesting ride.
I think it's getting more interesting as education goes down the no child messed around with line, where testing and testing becomes the primary objective, it seems, in too many of our schools. There's always been, of course, a problem with schools sometimes tending towards confusing education with filling up with facts, and every parent, you know, has seen a little bit of that at least. With the emphasis on testing, it's getting much, much worse. And so it's actually the clash is quite extreme. We are still generally educating children towards taking tests and doing well as individuals. And at the same time, our children are off doing their homework together because they're doing it on the computer, with word processing, of course. But if they're on the computer, they're on instant messaging. And if they're on instant messaging, they're talking with their friends. And what else are they going to talk about except what did you get for number six? So they're doing their homework together. And blogging, there's lots of experiments now using blogging in classrooms. One of the ones that I find really exciting is actually from Rebecca McKinnon, who's also at the Berkman Center. These are all people whose blogs you should be reading, by the way, who found one at Georgetown, I believe. It was a class blog. That is, a class that set up a blog. Many blogs are group blogs. They're not all by individuals. Some of the best ones are, in fact, written by bunches of people. So this is a blog that's created for a class. Anybody in the class can contribute, and you read through it, and here are students who are pulling in items off the news and saying, oh, I just read this. You know, the topic is, the thing was a poli-sci class, and they were pulling in stuff about North Korea and commenting back and forth on it, and somebody blogs about this or how they – I read this in the reading material, but I disagreed with it. Here's what I think, and somebody responds to that. What more could you want? What more could you want from your class that they're doing that on their own? It's all like total extra credit without even, you know, credit. So it can turn into a really exciting environment in which people learn together.
Okay, can I add something to that? Because I'm fascinated by this question of education, and I think it has major consequences in terms of blogs, and not just blogs, but SMS, all the media that the children can use among themselves, change three things at least. Changes authority. Every time that a new medium comes, authority changes. I can remember the reading about this fantastic research done by a chief librarian in the Newberry Library about medieval text authority and how students in universities could read a text and criticize in the background, in the back of the class, they could actually criticize the professor who used to use the authority of the voice. That was the authority of the Middle Ages. And then suddenly the authority of the text challenges the authority of the voice. So that's a major change. SMS and blogs do the same. And teachers are very wary of this. And they realize that what they have to do is the second big change, which is that they have to move to collaborative practice. They get their kids to work together and do work together and build. Then that's the third one. Building knowledge together, collaborating, and then spreading and sharing the authority. I think these are very key changes that are happening in the educational system now, and you'll find that there'll be more of that rather than less.
So let's move back to this audience in the back.
Do you see Christianity being threatened or challenged or emasculated as we go from the Dewey Decimal System to the internet? And do Judaism and Islam and Buddhism feel empowered, at least in libraries or on the web? And did Howard Dean find out that Job was his favorite old New Testament book from a blog or the internet rather than from an actual Bible?
Maybe several questions in that one.
Yes, and let's see. Which, first of all, you're asking the wrong Christian. I'm a Jew. I've never heard anybody complain about the Dewey Decimal System's ordering on religious grounds. It's just sitting there sort of unobserved, and I don't think anybody cares. So, no, I don't think that the Dewey Decimal System constitutes an assault on any particular religion. I'd like to go on the record about that. As for Howard Dean's Book of Job, beats me. Yeah.
Did he find it after he lost it or before?
Did he at one point get asked, what's your favorite book, and say Job, or was that just a sardonic comment?
Well, yeah, it was also, he inaccurately represented Job as being in the New Testament.
That was my understanding during the campaign. But I also was just concerned about how accurate and how trustworthy can we rely on blogs and the internet?
You cannot rely on any blog to be trustworthy, but you can rely upon the collection of blogs to be quite trustworthy. And in fact, well, I hesitate to say this, but in many ways, I'm going to regret saying this, but it's with the qualification, it's true. In many ways, I trust weblogs, the collection of weblogs, more than I trust the news media. Certainly more than I trust televised news. Sorry.
Well,
weblogs are self-correcting, and they frequently go wrong, but frequently they are also corrected.
David, this is another question from a viewer in Brookline, Massachusetts, who says he's a neighbor, and asks this question: will we see a collaborative rating system which can help researchers quickly ascertain the reliability of what they're reading? This, again, gets to the authority and reliability question.
It's impossible. We might. We already have rating systems. It's pretty much called email. Email is a global recommendation system by which we say, oh, this, you got to see this. I know you're interested in this stuff. here's something you ought to read. So email and weblogs are already a type of recommendation system. The problem with rating systems is that the same as the problem with universal categorization schemes, which is they don't, as they get larger and larger, they become less attuned to the individual values that they're supposed to be representing. So the possibility of having a universal rating system is, it would be useless if it were universal. So we might well see local rating systems. That is, I'm not so much interested in what everybody on the web thinks about Kenmore or Howard Dean or whatever. I'm much more interested in the set of people who I know one way or another, what they think. So a rating system that worked across local communities, virtual communities, that would be more interesting to me. Who knows what's going to be invented is really the question. No.
I know there's still lots of questions and time is running out. Yes.
Hi. My name is Carrie Carpenter. I'm actually an internet sociologist from the University of California, Irvine, and actually I was an embedded researcher with the Howard Dean for President campaign. I worked on the web team, and I helped out with the weblog. So one of the things that I'm interested in is not only there's this notion that blogs are sort of an atom of conversation. Most of the times blogs are one person, one voice, and then there's other people who comment or point to other people's weblogs. And I think it's sort of fundamentally changed with the Howard Dean campaign, where you had multiple people writing on the same blog and a community of thousands and thousands of people commenting around the blog. And also how that plays out into political action and whether or not a campaign will be successful or will not be successful when blogs are in play. So how do you, since you were one of the internet advisors for the Howard Dean campaign, how do you see Howard Dean's experience and particularly Howard Dean's weblog changing politics or changing the way that politics get played?
Oh, if only. a couple ways. The first is that we're used to having two voices who speak for a campaign. You have the candidate and you have the press secretary. You had Howard Dean, you had Tricia Enright, right? And everybody else can't speak for the campaign. The Dean campaign hired this guy, Matthew Gross, yep. And then a bunch of more bloggers, who's a kid, he's 31 and at the time. And this is a guy who writes a weblog on the site, on the Howard Dean site. It becomes the focus of the Howard Dean website, which was the focus in many ways of the Howard Dean campaign, and it's just this guy, and it works because he's somebody who speaks in his own voice and sort of speaks for the campaign, but sort of doesn't speak for the campaign, and we've never had a third voice in a campaign before. Now, the second thing is much harder to get at, but I think you'll know what I mean anyway, which is in ways that are really hard to describe. You had postings every day on the Howard Dean weblog by a number of people. We got to know them. We liked them. We trusted them. There were comments. You could comment on each of the entries. There would be 400 in an hour, easily 400 comments posted. There were people who posted regularly into the comments. The Dean campaign was very generous with the other links on their page to hundreds of other weblogs. 394, thank you very much. Approximately 394, I'm told. People who got their links onto that page felt like this was their blog, that the Howard Dean blog was their blog. People who are regular contributors to the comments would get recognized by other people. This was their blog. And not only did it feel like their blog, the community felt knitted together by this community of voices. You felt like you already knew the people in the campaign, and that was tremendously invigorating in a way that most political campaigns are tremendously demeaning. Here's the message. You're the foot soldiers. Go door to door and repeat the message. You might as well be selling Tide or something. Dean campaign, because it was willing to give up some control of the message and because it used the weblog and other techniques, but to allow voices, our voices, to emerge, not just the official voice of the campaign, which traditionally is too tight and boring anyway. Because it allowed our voices to emerge, we formed a movement around it, one by one, and that was amazing. And I miss that very, very much in the rest of the campaign, the Kerry campaign.
Do you think that it will be done the same in future campaigns? One of the things that I've seen...
You need the
microphone.
One of the things that I've seen in the Kerry campaign in particular, I guess I shouldn't really be casting aspersions, but that the weblog was not cast in the same light and that people didn't use the technology in the same way. So basically one of my fundamental questions is I think that what we did in the Dean campaign was inviting people into the message and giving people the autonomy and the authority to go out and do things on behalf of the campaign that turned it in from a political campaign in the traditional sense to a political movement.
I'm going to interrupt and give people a final chance. We're running out of time, and I think we're getting into another kind of speech. So if you don't mind, I'm going to move to the back and ask for the speaker back there.
Hi. When I look, Dr. Weinberger, at your four differences between digital info and traditional info, I'm struck by how that does or does not differ from a more traditional discourse. For example, if you have a history student who goes to southern France and reads the archives from former French colonies in Africa and is praised for pulling together little bits of disparate information and uses this information for their own purposes, and let's say this scholar uses information from a court trial that was used to convict somebody of stealing, but then they use the information to do a study about migrant farmers. And then they write a dissertation, they publish a book, and then somebody writes a book review on that, and that gets published in a traditional journal. That seems to cover all four of the areas you brought up. So I'm wondering if, aside from the speed with which it can happen on the internet and the amount that can happen on the internet, if there's any fundamental difference, particularly when you consider that a billion people still don't have web access.
5 billion people. 5 billion people don't have web access. Right? Maybe a billion optimistically do. That's absolutely, you're absolutely right. And I don't mean to say there's nothing new. We're not capable of novelty. We're just, you know, we're stuck with what we have. So I'm not saying that this has never happened before. What I'm suggesting maybe is that you don't have to be a grad student studying French history, go to the south of France, go through the records, that every one of us do it every time we go to a site. That it is, in that sense, it is simply a matter of more often by more people. It lowers the barriers to knowledge so dramatically that knowledge actually, the authority of knowledge shifts hands. It goes from experts to voices in conversation, and those voices are everyone's. So in some sense, that's simply a matter of quantity. But in fact, I believe that it's a substantial difference in both the shape of knowledge and the politics of knowledge as well. Not entirely new, of course not.
I'm going to ask another quick question from a viewer in Fairfax, California. Can blogs be used as evidence in court?
Of insanity, perhaps. I don't know.
Okay. Interesting question. All right, Arthur, let's...
Well, I do hope that 50 million bloggers can do better than 50 million Frenchmen. But I'm wondering something. I had a conversation this week with a very interesting woman who has been hired by the Chinese government to organize a program to train one-third of the population to speak English in the next 12 years. And given that's a truthful statement, or even if it's not, what would it mean if we no longer, quote-unquote, own our language, if a billion Chinese or other people in the world speak English, which is our common tongue? What does that do to our language? What does that do to our communication? How does that change our world?
It's a great question, again, to which I have No answer. That's, I'm really glad you... Okay.
I would suggest that we don't own our language now. That may be what you're, the trend you're suggesting may be a difference of quantity, but it's certainly not a difference of quality. I've had the experience in the last year of participating in a number of international conferences at which it's very clear that English is, to coin a phrase, the lingua franca of these kinds of discussions, and everyone has their language and English. And I think it's very clear that we no longer, if we ever did, we certainly no longer own English as a proprietary thing. We don't control the development of neologisms. We do not control the way discourse is shaped. If we ever did, we certainly don't any longer.
This is, it's been a subject of anxiety for quite a while, that either the control of the empire of English on the world or the loss of that empire. And on the internet, if you read Wired regularly, which I did, after a while you realize that this was constantly evolving. Online, English was actually losing ground. It began by being something like between 90 and 100% all languages used online, and gradually fell down to 80 and then 60, and I think now it's somewhere about 57 or something like this. It's still dominant, but it's very normal for this to happen. The question is very interesting, though. The question that teaching English to one-third of the Chinese population is an enormous challenge, I think, but let's say that it actually works. Would it be really different than Robert just said, that the common use of English, in fact, is creating, without threatening the identity of the people who are using the language as a second language, it is creating a common ground. The wonderful thing about English is that it can do that, and it does this reasonably well, and the anxiety over the imperialistic dominance of English over the rest, in fact, hasn't materialized. The only question that I'm asking myself is that there was one time when Latin was just like that. Latin was the lingua franca, was the dominant, and see where it got. So...
It had a good run.
It had a good run.
And, let's have one final question from the lady in the back.
I actually wanted to turn back to the issue of what this can mean for libraries and Library of Congress, so maybe it's fortunate that I can turn things in a circle that way at the end. But I just got back from a conference of the American Studies Association this past weekend where I happened to be in a session about virtual communities and the whole question of real versus virtual, and then also was lucky enough to attend a very excellent session about, it was called What Can American Studies Do for Libraries and What Can Libraries Do for American Studies, but it certainly by extension would be the humanities and social sciences, what can we do for each other. And what I'd like to sort of raise a question and then turn it back to you for make a point and then turn it back to you for a question, which is, it seems to me that some of the suggestions you're making about the big revolution that we're seeing with blogging in particular, it depends on your reference frame, because Usenet was the big revolution 15 years ago, and Moz and Muds and other real-time environments were the big revolution. And even now you have what I actually was talking about at the conference, where online social networks like Friendster. What's interesting, though, is that depending on the time frame and also the scope, your users may or may not actually control the shape of knowledge, because in a system like Friendster, you just get one page and someone else decides what the page will look like. And even with blogs, most people are using prepackaged software, and unless they go to the length of learning how to do it themselves, the software underlying is still challenging the form. Now, if I can extend that to the library, we are working very hard to digitize primary materials from the past so that more and more users around the country and the world can see the original and interact with it directly. At the same time, what you're suggesting to us is that we're moving from a model where there's a single evidence-based reality to a social reality, and that rather that knowledge is becoming more of a social reality. And so we in libraries are offering the first kind of reality. If we show them the original Declaration of Independence, they can sort of grok it immediately, versus the kind of knowledge that's being developed in blog communities, which is a social reality. And so I'm wondering how you see that whole issue of realness playing into what's happening on the web. Where is it real and where is it not so real?
So you're ending with, what is reality? I don't mean to suggest that that the internet is allows for a purely social construction of reality apart from what's actual in the world. And I'm going to use the terms loosely because that's all I can do. Okay, it's certainly the case that much of what you see in the web logs and elsewhere are reactions to or comments on what's showing up in the media as objective fact. That's a lot of, so there is, and always will be, an intermingling, one refracting the other. I think it's way, and I think you probably agree, that it's way too simple, would be way too simple to say libraries represent objectivity and the old world, and blogs represent socially constructed reality and the new world. There's only one world. And there are various ways and media of refracting on it. The web and weblogs have certain strengths and certain, it's not just strengths, a certain form. They form the discourse in a particular way. Real-world libraries form the discourse in a different way. Those things will always be mingled, especially as you're digitizing the texts. It's an enormously useful thing to do.
Well, it's clear that we could continue these questions and discussions for a long time, but I'm afraid the evening must come to a close. So let me thank David Weinberger for an excellent talk. We do appreciate it very much. And to my colleagues, Derek DeKirchhoff, Robert Martin, and Eric Delfino, thank you for participating and adding to the discussion, and thank all of you for coming.
Thank you.